Well, I'm going to record this part of the slideshow, not only because I need to finish the slideshow, but during the laboratory component, because it applies to this and lecture. Of course, the whole slideshow is part of the lecture exam material, but this is also important for what you're doing today on the lab, and therefore, you know, this is important for quiz material as well. The worksheet you can get to after I get through this, but what I want you to, you know, yesterday, or the last time we met, that was basically an opportunity to just get acquainted with the microscope, to how to use it properly. You might have looked at various things, but I want you to look at those things much closer today, the things in your box of slides, which is part of doing the worksheet. You should do the worksheet in order, but get a better view of them today, especially based on what I tell you for the rest of this chapter. Just by coincidence, 29 was exactly the correct way, the correct place to take a break, because the rest of this slideshow has to do with tissues. First part was cells. Now we're into tissues, and think about what that means. We're at a different level in the hierarchy of biological organization, right? Tissues are collections of cells that come together to form a tissue that does a specific job. What do we call the study of tissues? Do you remember that? No, cytology is the study of cells. So the study of tissues is its own science.
Right.
Histology. The study of cells, the study of tissues, which is what we're dealing with right now. And not all organisms have tissues. For instance, obviously unicellular organisms don't have tissues, right? They only have one cell. But even not all multicellular organisms have tissues. All humans do. And all animals, almost all animals in general, have tissues, but how many and what kind of tissues you have depends on your species. Do you remember how many I said humans have?
Tissues?
Well, how many tissue types? Yeah, major categories. Four, right. And can you name those four? No, that's a subcategory. Epithelial tissue is one. Right, connective tissue, nervous tissue, and muscle tissue. We should set this one aside because it's weak. So no matter what sample of your body you take, you're going to get 1 to 4 of these. There's no other types of tissue, major categories of tissue in a human. Epithelial, nervous, and muscle tissue all are pretty specific in what they do, and there's not all that much variety within each of those categories. Connective tissue is kind of like a catch-all category four, meaning that everything, whether it's really involved in directly connecting things together or not, which is why it's named that, anything that's not nervous, epithelial, or muscle tissue is connective tissue. All right. We'll start, though, on slide 30 with epithelial tissue. And I already told you that epithelia, which is the plural of epithelium, a single tissue, epithelia line surfaces, right? They line organs or surfaces of the body either exteriorly or interiorly. And when you consider any given epithelium, which of course is many cells, like any tissue is, there is first of all polarity to that tissue, to that epithelium. Polarity, remember, means that one side is different from the other. In this sense of the word, polarity has nothing to do with charge. The polarity of epithelium comes from the fact that one side is attached and the other side isn't. So any epithelium is built on In other words, those cells are connected to an underlying thing called the basement membrane. And so that forms the basal surface. Basal being the adjective of base. All right? The basal surface is the attached surface of the epithelium. The other side is free or unattached, like the surface of the skin that you can touch. This surface of the epidermis is unattached, right? It's just in connection with the air. So that is called the apical surface, the unattached surface. Apical is the adjective of apex, which means the tip. That's true for any epithelium. Any epithelium has a basal surface and an apical surface. Okay, that's the polarity that I was talking about. Now, there's two major ways of classifying an epithelium, meaning specifying exactly what kind of epithelium you have. And those two ways of classifying them don't have anything to do with each other. One way you classify an epithelium is based on how many layers of cells there are. Now, any epithelium is obviously many cells. But you can see in the top example that those cells all form one layer. So as you go from the basal surface to the apical surface, you're only going through one cell thickness. And any epithelium that's made up of just one layer of cells is called a simple epithelium. The only other possibility is that there's some number greater than one of layers. So it doesn't matter how many more than one. Two, three, anything more than one, we call it a stratified epithelium, meaning occurring in strata, the plural of stratum, which simply means layer. So it's a layered epithelium. Okay? Now, if you have a stratified epithelium, the shapes of the cells deeper in toward the basal surface might not be the same as the shape of the cells in the apical surface. And that can make a difference in something I'm going to say in just a little bit. Now let's go on to slide 31 and talk about a totally different way of classifying epithelia. It has nothing to do with how many layers there are. This way of classifying them has only to do with the shape of the cells in the apical layer. Okay? And so you're looking at individual cells now that are just part of the epithelium. And an individual epithelial cell can have any of three shapes. When we're looking at them here on the side view, well, the right, these are kind of three-dimensional. These are side views. You're looking at the edge of the epithelium, in other words. So the basal surface would be toward the bottom and the apical surface would be toward the top of the picture in this cartoon. But each of them has a width that's pretty much the same, right? The height is what's different. And so if you're talking about a cell that is much thinner vertically, much shorter, in other words, than it is wide, which is, if you looked at it from the top, would look like a floor tile, not very thick, right, compared to its width, then that's called a squamous epithelial cell. Squamous means scale-like. Scales are thin as well. If, on the other hand, it's roughly as thick or tall as it is wide, then it forms three-dimensionally more or less a cube, and therefore we call it a cuboidal cell. And then the only other possibility is that it's thicker or taller than it is wide, like a column, an architectural column. So we call those columnar cells. And so cuboidal, you know, doesn't have to be perfectly exactly as high as it is wide, but it's roughly in one of these three categories. That's how you categorize individual cells. Well, when you categorize the entire epithelium, if it's a simple epithelium, by definition, it only has one layer, right? So all those cells will pretty much be the same. That's easy. But in all cases, you classify an epithelium based on cell shape by classifying the cell shape in the apical layer. Well, the apical layer is the only layer a simple one has. In the case of a stratified, You just don't pay attention to the shapes of the deeper ones, only the ones that are in the free surface, the apical surface. Okay? So that can lead to six major possibilities. When you combine the two ways of classifying, either simple or stratified, and then also for each of those two, either cuboidal, columnar, or squamous. And therefore, you get the overall phrases. You can have a simple squamous, a stratified squamous, a simple cuboidal, a stratified cuboidal, a simple columnar, and a stratified columnar. Okay, those are six major categories. Well, the table in slide 32 kind of explains this again in different words. So I won't reread that to you, but transitional is shown here as well. Transitional is kind of a special category. And you see this, for instance, in your urinary bladder. Transitional means that it changes, right? It undergoes a transition. Well, the reason that the urinary bladder can stretch as much as it can, and it's amazing how much it can stretch, actually, before it will injure itself, way beyond when you think you have to empty it. It can get much bigger than that, usually. Anyway, it's able to do that because when there's not much urine in it, when the bladder is empty, it's more stratified. It's made up of multiple layers of cells, and the cells tend to be columnar. And then when it's stretched, those what were separate layers slip past each other, and it becomes fewer layers, so that those cells can then fill in what would be holes that you would be tearing in the wall. You see what I'm saying? And the columnar shape gets stretched into more squamous shape, also to take up that extra area. And so there's a limit, of course. It will burst, but it's pretty stretchy because of that. So that's what transitional refers to. It's kind of a special case. Now let's blow through some slides to just look at specific examples of these major categories I told you. Here we have simple squamous epithelium. A perfect example is the epithelium lining the interior of the lungs, which is made up of tiny sacs. It's simple because it's one layer. It's squamous because that the cells in that apical layer are thinner than they are wide. And this is ideal for lungs because lungs function to allow oxygen to diffuse into the bloodstream and allow carbon dioxide to diffuse out of the bloodstream into the lungs so you can get rid of it. Notice I said diffuse. We already talked about diffusion. That process works wonderfully well only over tiny distances. For instance, if you had something that your life requires it, that you had to diffuse from your foot to your head, it might take decades for that to happen and you'd be long dead by that time. Which is why you need bulk flow involving your blood. That's convection, not diffusion. But anyway, diffusion works really well as long as the distance that it moves is tiny. And therefore, if your diffusion is occurring through an epithelium, which it is at the lungs, you want that distance to be minimized. Well, simple minimizes it in terms of number of layers, and squamous minimizes it beyond that, right? This is the thinnest an epithelium can be, so it's ideally suited for that. Notice it makes it very vulnerable because you have this very thin and single layer, but it's well protected because it's an invagination into your body. You're not rubbing against it all the time like you are on your skin. 34, simple cuboidal. Once again, it's simple only because there's one layer, but it's cuboidal-shaped cells, so it's overall a simple cuboidal epithelium. Good example, as you see here, is in the tubules that make up the kidneys. Now, it's not really correct to say that the kidney wants to have these to be cuboidal. If it could accomplish it with a thinner one, that would be enough. But the reason that simple cuboidal epithelium in the kidneys is cuboidal rather than squamous is because the job of these tubules is to do a lot of secretion, which we've talked about before, which involves a lot of internal machinery inside the cell, which takes up room. And so they can't be that thin, really. They're only as thin as they can be, which is cuboidal in this case. But notice on the micrograph, each one of these circles is a little tubule that's been transversely cut. And so you can see that's one cell thick. This is the interior of the tube, but the wall of the tube is one cell thick, and they're cuboidal cells, so it's simple cuboidal. Okay, 35, simple columnar. Once again, simple because it's only one layer, but now they're columnar-shaped cells. And so these require even more internal machinery and therefore have to be even thicker. A good example, though, is in the gut, which involves a lot of absorption. A lot of transport proteins have to be embedded in that membrane, and therefore that requires a pretty thick cell. 36. This one is another special case. It's called pseudostratified. Now, what does the prefix pseudo mean in general? No, that's poly. Like a pseudo-intellectual, for instance. Pseudo means false. So someone who thinks they're intellectual, but they're actually not all that smart, is a pseudo-intellectual. Pseudo-stratified means falsely stratified. And so don't be confused by this word. Even though stratified is in the name, a pseudo-stratified epithelium is really a simple epithelium, but it's a special case. It's a simple epithelium that has the appearance, the false appearance, of being stratified. And the reason for this is that unlike a normal simple epithelium in which all the cells are pretty much alike, so they're all the same thickness, in a pseudostratified epithelium, some of the cells are tall and some of them are short, but they're all just one layer. So it looks like some of these cells are above other cells, but they're not. The reason you know that they're not, the reason that you can tell it's one layer, is because every cell, regardless of how tall it is directly connected to the basement membrane. So it has to be part of that same layer, right? It's kind of like carpet with different lengths of pile, right? You have long fibers and short fibers, but they're all in direct contact with the underlayment, whatever that part of the carpet is called. Okay, so that's pseudostratified. 37, stratified squamous. So remember that a stratified has to have more than one layer, but the reason it's squamous is only because of the shape of the apical layer. You don't care about whether these are cuboidal or columnar down here. Only this surface matters. So you first determine whether it's simple or stratified, and if once you know that it's stratified, then you look at the apical surface cells and determine their shape. Here you see the lining of the throat. The epidermis that we've talked about several times would be another example. These are the vagina would be another example. All of these things have in common that they undergo a lot of abrasion, right? When you swallow food, that's scraping on that epithelium the whole way down. So that scraping removes thousands of cells every time you rub it. And if you only had a simple epithelium, you'd be taking away that only layer of cells you have, right? Therefore, things that have to undergo abrasion, have to stand up to abrasion, are stratified so that you have plenty of layers. And the cells that you're losing continuously, I mean, even the wind blowing on you is removing skin cells. Those are, by the time they get to the point where you can feel them, those are already dead cells in the case of your skin. But you lose millions of them, therefore you have to replace millions of them every day to maintain the overall same number, otherwise you'd run out of skin. The new ones, though, are added from below, and then they eventually make it to that surface, and then it get removed. 38, transitional epithelium, I mentioned before, is the urinary bladder. And notice when it's relaxed, there's a lot of layers, but when it gets stretched, those layers slip past each other and form fewer layers to take up the room. Okay, that was epithelium, which is one major kind of tissue, right? Next, we're going to look at connective tissues. And remember I said they have a connective function, pretty much, but sometimes it's not really obvious that it's connective. That's why I say it's kind of catch-all. Everything that's not one of the other three groups is a connective tissue. And there's the greatest variety of tissue types are found in the connective tissues. So we're looking at just one kind of connective tissue in slide 39, which is one that is really easy to spot in the microscope. So if you had to name these things without being told what they are, you'd want this to be a slide that's used because it's pretty obvious. It has this appearance that you see on the right. This is a real photomicrograph. We're looking at bone here. And bone is connective tissue. Now, bone, along with all the other connective tissues, in other words, any connective tissue, has two major components to it. There's a cellular component, meaning whatever types of cells are in that tissue. And then there's stuff that's outside of all those cells. And collectively, that stuff, whatever it is called the extracellular matrix. Now, think back to when we were looking at epithelium. Notice that there wasn't much stuff between cells. It was mostly cells packed together. Well, there's still cells in connective tissues, but there's a lot of extracellular matrix between those cells. And what that extracellular matrix is totally different from one connective tissue to another. In bone, the overall connective tissue is bone. There are bone cells called osteocytes. Once again, site meaning cell, and the ost part of that means bone, like in osteoporosis. That's the cellular component, obviously, those cells. And then there's a lot of hard mineralized material that makes the bones hard. That's the extracellular matrix. Well, this is a microscopic view. So within the wall of a bone, there would be millions of these circular-looking things. But each one, each major circle here, is called an osteon, same root as in osteocyte. Structural unit of bone, so that it's made of many, many osteons. But each osteon has a central canal. That's where blood vessels travel through. But then look at the surrounding part. It looks like several layers, concentric layers, like an archery target, of bony material, extracellular matrix that has been built up. That forms one osteon. Okay. These smaller dark spots within those layers are called lacunae, plural of lacuna. Lacuna means lagoon, and it's not really a structure. It's really just a space in that hard outer stuff. But it doesn't remain a space. It has to be a space so that a cell can occupy that little lagoon. And so osteocytes live in and take up the space of a lacuna. Okay, that's bone. Pretty unmistakable. It doesn't look like any other tissues on slides. Next on 40 is another connective tissue called cartilage, but this specifically is hyaline cartilage. Now, first of all, cartilage is connective tissue, but there are different categories of cartilage, only one of which is hyaline cartilage, which we're looking at here. Hyaline, that word means glassy. And that's a good descriptor because in a microscope, hyaline cartilage appears like this, and the cells look like they're in bubbles within glass. There's hyaline cartilage different places on the body, but you see big chunks of it right here on either side of the sternum, between the sternum and the ribs. And that's kind of glassy in appearance, but especially under a microscope. Cartilage is tough stuff, too. It is not as hard as bone, obviously. But it's very tough still. And so there have to be lacunae, or little spaces within cartilage, for cells to live in as well. By the way, these are not called osteocytes, these cells, because it's not bone. They're called chondrocytes. And whenever you see the chondro part of a word, that means cartilage. Another kind of cartilage. fibrocartilage, named for the fact that in its extracellular matrix, there's quite a few protein fibers, making it pretty strong stuff. And a good example of this, it's not the only place in the body, but a good example, as you see in the slide, are the pads between vertebrae. Each bone of the spine, or the vertebral column, is called a vertebra, pluralis vertebrae, and between each pair of vertebrae, there is an intervertebral disc, or a pad of fibrocartilage that allows them, it holds them together well, which is really important, because if they move side to side, that's going to injure your spinal cord permanently. Right? So we talk about slipped discs. Discs don't slip. What happens is they herniate. You get a bulge that comes out of them, and that presses on nerves that are outside of the spinal cord. That's why it's painful. But they're held in place well, because this fibrocartilage is such tough stuff because of all those protein fibers. By the way, the main fiber type is collagen, which animals make in abundance. It's animal protein. Okay, 42. Here we have dense fibrous connective tissue. And the fibrous part, as you probably already figured out, means a bunch of protein fibers are in its extracellular matrix. That's what gives it this kind of stringy appearance. The dense word there refers to the packing of the fibers with respect to each other. So you can have dense and loose. Dense connective tissue means that those fibers are packed together closely. There's a lot of them packed into a small space. Looser tissues have a lot more space between the fibers. So a perfect example of these would be tendons. Tendons are connective tissues that on one end connect to a skeletal muscle and on the other end connect to the bone. You know, our muscles pull on our bones, but not directly. The muscles pull on the tendons, and the tendons don't stretch just like ropes don't, because they have all these fibers in them, protein fibers. And then the tendon pulls directly on the bone. So that has to be tough stuff. By the way, another word besides dense is regular. A tendon is not only dense, but it's regular connective tissue, as opposed to irregular. Regular and irregular refer to the orientation of the fibers. In a tendon, which is pulled on by a muscle, and remember I said muscles can only pull, they're always being pulled in the same direction. So they only need to be strong in that one direction, and therefore all their fibers are oriented in parallel. That's what it means to be regular, because they're never going to be pulled from the side, right? On the other hand, other tissues might have irregular connective tissue. Their fibers are going in all directions because they might be stretched in any given direction. 43. This is areolar tissue, which is also sometimes called loose connective tissue. And remember I said earlier that loose means that the fibers, there aren't all that many packed together. You see a lot of space between the fibers here. And so loose connective tissue is not particularly tough stuff. But that's okay, because it's not supposed, doesn't have to be for what it's supposed to be doing. Because of its looseness, it's able to move pretty freely. Now your skin is not just your epidermis. This is just used, I'm leading to an example of areolar tissue. Your skin is, I mean, your epithelium is just part of your skin, right? That's the epithelial part of your skin. Deep to that is the dermis, which is connective tissue, really, not epithelium, but it's still part of the skin. And then deeper than that is what we call the hypodermis, which is mostly fat and some areolar tissue as well. The fact that it's loose, it's kind of like packing material. So it's not holding you together, really, but it's allowing for free movement, which is why you can move your skin around pretty freely, because it's not connected directly to stuff that's held in place. that's connected to this areolar loose tissue. 44, adipose tissue. I said in the previous recording that adipose tissue is tissue made up of adipocytes, or adipose cells, which can also be called fat cells. And we've already talked about this, so I won't repeat that. Fat cells are specialized for containing as much fat as possible for the reasons I gave you before. Oh, by the way, I do want to say something about this, though. This is another one that people like to have on tests because it's pretty obvious that when you're looking at fat cells as well. They look empty, though. That's what I wanted to say. They're not empty, of course. They're full of fat when they're alive. But when you prepare a slide for microscopy, you usually stain it. You know, these colors that we see are not the real colors of these things. Some things in real life are colored, especially plants, because they have to have pigments to absorb light. That's why they look colored. And we have some pigments in our bodies, but a typical animal cell, if you just look at it in isolation, is pretty transparent and therefore hard to see pieces of. If you stain it, it not only gives it some color, but it gives it color in just certain parts that take that stain up easily, and other parts don't take the stain up, so it differentiates the parts. Well, in that process of preparing fat cells for slides, the fat gets dissolved away. So what you see is empty at that point, but it wouldn't be in real life. That's what makes them unmistakable, though, a bunch of empty cells. 45, reticular tissue. Now, reticular has reti as a root, kind of a weird word you probably never heard of, but reti means a web-like network. And a reticulum, that iculum ending, just means a small version of that. So a small network, web-like network. And that's what reticular is the adjective of. The fibers in reticular tissue are kind of loose also, but they're arranged in this kind of web-like pattern to operate more or less as a filter. So you have this in your lymph nodes, for instance, filtering things that can harm you. And you also have this in your spleen, which is an important organ for, that's the example shown here, an important organ that filters out red blood cells that have seen better days. The reason you lose billions of red blood cells every day is that they can't live very long. And there's a couple reasons for this. Red blood cells are specialized for carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, which requires hemoglobin to attach those molecules to. Hemoglobin, in other words, oxygen and carbon dioxide ride on hemoglobin molecules within the cells. And to be maximally efficient, red blood cells have evolved to pack as many possible hemoglobin molecules into them. There are many, many billions of red blood cells in your body, and every single one of them has millions of hemoglobin molecules inside that one cell. And that's because as they develop, red blood cells lose all the other contents. There's no nucleus, there's no mitochondria, it's just a bag full of hemoglobin pretty much. Well, since it doesn't have a nucleus and therefore doesn't have any DNA, it can't make any proteins to keep itself operational, right? It can't repair itself. So that alone means it can't live very long. But also, it wears out pretty quickly because of what it does. The red blood cells have to squeeze through capillaries. And I say squeeze because the diameter of the capillary is actually even smaller than the diameter of the red blood cell. So they have to squeeze through there, and that just wears them out. So the spleen filters those older ones out, lets the good ones through back into the bloodstream, but the old worn out ones are killed and broken down for parts so that you can build new proteins out of the stuff that used to be hemoglobin. Okay. Blood is next in 46. First of all, blood is a tissue I want you to recognize. We usually think of tissues as being things that stay in place. Blood is a mobile tissue, but it is not only a tissue, it's a connective tissue, like bone and everything else. that we've talked about in the connective tissue section. And just like all those other connective tissues, bone fulfills the criteria of being a connective tissue, meaning there's a cellular component, the cells themselves, almost all of which are red blood cells, but you also have white blood cells of five types. That's the cellular component of the tissue. And then you have extracellular matrix. What do we specifically call the extracellular matrix of blood?
Plasma.
That's plasma. Right. Everything that's still part of blood but is outside of the cells is plasma, which is why you get plasma by taking whole blood and spinning it down in a centrifuge. The heavy cells fall to the bottom, and all that stuff at the top, the liquid component, that's the extracellular matrix, plasma. Okay, so that is connective tissue. Now in 47, we're looking at muscle tissue. And there are three major kinds or categories of muscle tissue. Only one is shown here, but let me tell you that the three kinds are skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. And this is kind of confusing because it would be reasonable, based on the name muscular system, to assume that the muscular system includes all three of these types. But it doesn't. The muscular system, as an organ system, contains skeletal muscle, but that's the only kind of muscle tissue. Cardiac means of the heart, right? So cardiac muscle makes up the heart, most of the stuff of the heart, and therefore it's part of the circulatory system. And smooth muscle is found in many different organ systems, usually lining hollow organs, like the intestines, for instance. The operation of smooth muscles can force things through the contents of those intestines through them. Okay, well anyway, we're looking at skeletal muscle here. All kinds of muscle tissue, though, is excitable tissue. Excitable means it's able to create and transmit what are called action potentials, which are electrochemical signals. Now, of the four types of tissue overall, two of them are excitable. What's the other excitable one?
Cardiac.
Cardiac is part of muscle. Besides muscle tissue, what other tissue is excitable?
Nervous tissue.
Nervous tissue, yes, which we haven't quite got to yet. But muscle tissue, whether it's skeletal, cardiac, or smooth, is excitable. It also, in all three cases, contracts, like I was saying earlier. That's the only thing that it can do actively, is get shorter. And all three of the types do this. But the cells are arranged differently for the three types. Skeletal muscle, shown here, is made up of individual skeletal muscle cells, which can also be called myofibers or muscle fibers, which that's kind of confusing terminology too, because I've used the word fiber different ways, right? Fibers, proteins can be fibers, but in this case, a fiber, a myofiber, myo meaning muscle, is a whole cell, okay? A whole muscle, like the biceps brachii, is made up of many, many individual cells. But in a skeletal muscle, a whole skeletal muscle, the individual cells run the entire length of that whole muscle. There's just a bunch of them side by side. All right. Now, these really long muscle cells or myofibers are like, for skeletal muscle, are like cylinders, non-branching cylinders. Okay? Kind of like a long pencil. And we're only seeing part of the overall length here as the width of this picture. These would be much longer. But this is one cell, this is the next cell, and so on. And within those cylindrical skeletal muscle cells, you have very regular banding patterns called striations. And so we say that skeletal muscle is striated muscle because of those striations. And this is what makes skeletal muscle easy to spot. Not only do you have these striations, but they are basically all oriented the same for all the muscle cells. And that's because they don't branch, right? If they were to branch, then some of them would be going different directions. But they're all in parallel, so the striations are all in parallel at the in 90 degrees to that. All right, now that's not... For skeletal muscle, it can only contract if it's given a signal coming from a nervous system. A neuron tells the skeletal muscle to move, which is why you have to think about moving to move your skeletal muscles. That's not true for the other kinds of muscles, thankfully. You don't have to remember to beat your heart every second. And so the other two types of muscle, cardiac muscle, which we see in 48, and smooth, which we'll see in the next one, are examples of autorhythmic muscle. Auto means self, and rhythmic here refers to the to its contraction. It contracts over and over. Autorhythmically means contracting on its own over and over, which is why a heart, if you cut it all the way out of a body, will still beat for a while till it runs out of energy. Now, cardiac muscle, making up the heart, is also striated, but the striations aren't quite as regular because the cylinders that the individual cardiac cells are branched. And so those branches go in different directions, and therefore the striations are arranged in different directions. So it's not all lined up like it is for skeletal muscle. Forty-nine is the third category of muscle, smooth muscle. And these ones are not cylindrical shaped, these cells, I should say. Instead, they're described as spindle-shaped, which means they're thicker in the middle and then they taper to points at the ends. And they also have a different molecular architecture inside them, so we don't see the striations. They still contract like the other muscles, but they do it a slightly different way molecularly, so we don't see those striation lines. And that's one way of telling that you're not looking at cardiac or skeletal, no striations. But if you look closely in individual cells, you can also see the tapering spindle shape. Okay, that's muscle tissue. So the only one we haven't covered is nervous tissue, which we see an example of in 50. Now, nervous tissue contains many cells, obviously, by definition of being a tissue. But there are two major categories of nervous tissue cells, one of which is neurons. And neurons are the excitable cells within nervous tissue. Those are the ones that create and transmit these electrochemical signals that get sent to other neurons or get sent to muscles or get sent to glands to tell those things what to do. This is how the nervous system controls other systems. All right? And you see some neurons right here. Remember from the other picture I showed you that a neuron has a fairly large cell body. That's where the neuron is. And it has some things that are called dendrites connecting to the cell body. Those are like inputs. And then it has a long axon extending from the cell body. That's the output. So they're kind of weirdly shaped cells that are pretty recognizable. But that's just one of the categories. The other category of cells within the nervous tissue, which is made up of different kinds of cells, but collectively that other category is called neuroglia. The glia part of that means glue, really. So nerve glue is really what this means, literally. But that can also be called glial cells. There are different categories of those, and they do different jobs specifically, but what's different about neuroglia as a category compared to neurons is that neuroglia are not excitable. So these don't create action potentials. Only the neurons do. But the neuroglia of the different kinds, in one way or another, support the neurons so that they can live and do their job. Okay? And that's really it. 51 is kind of a catch-all final slide that shows you that no matter where you are on the body, you have only these four types of tissue, and any given organ is usually going to contain multiple different tissues, maybe all four of them. So keep that in mind when you're looking at your slides again today, much more carefully as you go through this worksheet. Remember that a single slide might contain two or more categories of tissues of the four. You know, for instance, on the plantar skin one, I think you have one that's labeled as plantar skin from the bottom of the foot. Well, it depends on where you're looking at on the slide as to what tissue type you're looking at. If it's going to include skin, of course, that's going to have epidermis, which is epithelium. And then deep to that will be dermis, which is connective tissue. And then depending on the particular slide, because they're all different, deep to that you might have some adipose tissue, because there's padding there as well, right? So don't use a single slide for just one tissue type. Look at the whole slide. Move it around with the mechanical stage to see the difference in tissue types. But also, just as you go through this worksheet and look at these more carefully, just get an appreciation of how the various kinds of tissue look different compared to each other. Okay, go ahead.